Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
It was a long time a coming. I'm glad she left me when she did. I'll raise my glass and I'll start to sing. Thanks for the memories, the memories.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Brad Williams? Y'all like Brad? From Northeast Arkansas, Brad Williams cut his teeth on bluegrass and gospel music. While fronting the local country band, the Salty Dogs, Brad finds time to play guitar with local roots rockers Big Silver. For Big Silver and Salty Dogs music, visit iTunes. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to a very special edition of Tales from the South, a monthly series we call the Tin Roof Project, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, all right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark can be heard on blues legend John Weston's CDs, Blues at Daybreak, and Got to Deal with the Blues. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and tonight our featured artist is Little Rock painter Maura Weir. And the painting we're featuring is this small one up here, which is entitled Summer Harvest, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this painting and Maura at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? According to Booklist, novelist John Horner Jacobs' storytelling has the effortless velocity of early Dean Koontz, and his prose is textured with hard-boiled grit, an expertly spiced stew of attitude, humor, horror, and grief. A native Arkansan, John is represented by Stacia Decker of the Donald Moss Literary Agency. His first novel, Southern Gods, was published by Nightshade Books and shortlisted for the Bram Stoker Award. His second novel, This Dark Earth, was published in July 2012 by Gallery Pocket Books, an imprint of Simon & Schuster. His young adult series, The Incarcerado Trilogy, comprised of The 12-Finger Boy, Incarcerado, and The End of All Things, will be published by Carol Rhoda Labs, an imprint of Lerner Publishing. His first fantasy series, The Incorruptibles, will be published in spring 2014 by Galanz in the UK. John is also the co-founder of Needle, a magazine of noir, and was the active creative director until fall 2012. He lives in Little Rock with his wife and two daughters. Tonight, John takes us on the road with him and a motley crew. Ladies and gentlemen, John Horner Jacobs.
In 1996, I was 27 and going on my 14th year of adolescence. I'd watched as my friends had outpaced and then lapped me in the mad dash to adulthood, office jobs, wives, children, and sometimes wondered at my inability to make long-lasting connections or gain the respect I thought I deserved. It doesn't always happen like this, not always, but it usually starts this way. The phone rings, I pick it up, and George Paul Eldridge starts talking. Two words for you, he says, excited. R.V. That's two letters, I say. Shut up, man. Recreational vehicle. We're taking the moho to Lou's wedding. The plan is this. Get Daniel, Woodyard, Reisner, Gernati, Boyce, Eldridge, and myself in his father's RV, a threadbare and beaten-down specimen of recreational vehicle, tan, grimy, with a dank, musky smell, and fill it to bursting with booze and gasoline. Leave in the late afternoon and drive to Chicago throughout the night, a movable feast. There's no reason to attend a wedding if you can't start drinking 9 hours early. On the day of the trip, Eldridge keeps calling it the MOHO, and there's vigorous debate regarding what the MO stands for. Half of us are in the motor camp, and the other half in the mobile contingent. Eldridge lays down the law. It's motorhome, dudes. Don't be silly. You don't put gas in a house trailer. Historically, Interstate 40 East from Little Rock to Memphis is one of the worst stretches of highway in the nation. But we're doing fine, the MOHO shuddering and rocking on well-lubed shocks. Other than himself, Eldridge will allow only Reasoner behind the wheel. And Reasoner's driving now, smoking and mauling the wheel with big, raw-boned hands. We've all picked out seats, and the cases of beer sit iced in the shower stall along with the party ball, a translucent amber 3-gallon globe of beer. Chips and pretzels lie in particulate sprays on the mangy carpeted floor. The trash bags bulge with empty Solo cups and crushed beer cans. The RV cab has taken on a yeasty smell. But spirits are high. Gernati and Woodyard discuss the Bulls, the phenomenal power of Scottie Pippen and Michael Jordan, while Daniel chats with Boyce about law school and what he refers to as lawyering. Even the flat tire we have near Memphis isn't enough to dampen spirits. It's just a 2-hour delay, and most of that's due to the truck stop mechanics trying to figure out how to put the hub lock back on the patched tire. On the road again, Eldridge says, I was hanging out with Levon the other day. He matches a cigarette and takes a drink from a light beer. George Paul Eldridge is excitable in addition to having two first names. A dark-haired, olive-complected man, he prefers brightly colored clothes with stripes and tends to wear his pants high on his waist. He often punctuates his conversation with high kicks and air guitar. Unlike most of my high school friends, he manages to ride the line between respectable adult and nocturnal party monster. His father's a restaurateur, and Eldridge is active in the Memphis scene, booking bands for Blues City Cafe and fundraising for the King Biscuit Blues Festival. After the show, we went back to Levon's hotel, Eldridge said. We were pretty lit, you know. He ordered some food but barely touched it. Eldridge often talks about musicians, and being a musician myself, sometimes it's hard to take. He rattles off famous folk like Albert King, James Cotton, Levon Helm, all musical heroes of mine, as if he's on a first-name basis with them. He might be. I don't know. Most of them have some connection to Arkansas, so it's possible. So, Eldridge says, I snatched up his rice pudding because Levon didn't want it. He's lying in bed. The TV's on, right? And damn, it's delicious. But that's the way the whiskey's got me. Levon says, you know what makes that pudding so good? And I say, what? Levon says, that Arkansas basmati rice. Woodyard and Boyce laugh. The MOHO shudders and sways. Reasoner calls for a piss break, and Eldridge goes to the front of the MOHO. He cries, it's a fusion, as he slips behind the wheel, and Reasoner slips out. Eldridge throws his highest approbation, the heavy metal devil sign. We never slow under 70. No one spills a drop. It's night now, and we've been on the road long enough so that everyone's buzzed. Boyce unlimbers the whiskey bottle, and Daniel wants me to uncase the guitar and run through a few numbers. I want to play originals, but that's quickly shouted down. So I play Rocky Raccoon and Melissa, Midnight Rider and Willing, up on Cripple Creek and Ophelia. Even though we're traveling, musically, we don't stray too far from home. If you're a guitar player in the 90s, someone calling for Freebird is expected and dealt with accordingly. But someone calling for the band's The Wait is taken very seriously. I run through the intro, work through the first verse and chorus. It's a great song because it has no bridge, just verse, chorus, all the way through. And we get to the part where everyone's singing about taking a load off Annie and hitting the three-point harmony of and. We never reach, put the load right on me. Abruptly, the whole world shifts and slows. Daniel's mouth is an open bell, maybe from the last lyric with The Wait, or maybe in the beginning of a scream. Boyce's arms are splayed out and his face a study in alarm. The whole cab of the MOHO has lurched and shifted, tilting on axis. A tremendous metal tearing sound howls through the cab. Beer spill on the floor. The whiskey bottle topples. Reasoner grips the wheel, shoulders hunched. He's the only person not yelling. It's 2 a.m. outside of Mattoon, Illinois, and the wheels have come off the Moho. When it finally slews to a stop, we disembark from the crippled vehicle like stunned astronauts from a crash landing. We find the wheels in a cornfield a mile or more away. We've left a 100-yard scratch down the surface of the interstate. Everyone praises Reasoner for his quick thinking. The Moho could have easily flipped and rolled if he'd pumped the brakes, and we'd all be dead. Eldridge jabs a finger at me. "You, intellectual," he says, and turns to Reasoner. "You, plumber, walk to town and get a wrecker." It takes 8 hours to get the wheels put back on the Moho. By the time we reach Chicago and the hotel, it's been 24 hours since we've left Little Rock. After the close confines of the journey, Eldridge disappears. When he finally reappears the next day, it's minutes before the rehearsal dinner, and he's wearing a brand new green searced sucker suit. The tag's still on it, with white bucks and no socks. He's energetically drunk. He's been watching the Bulls at a local sports bar for most of the day, drinking margaritas. "But why a green seersucker?" Lewis, the groom, asks. "Aren't seersuckers supposed to be blue-striped?" "We were drinking margaritas. Ow!" Eldridge says, and then performs a high kick, his white buck flashing near eye level. Badass, isn't it? The rest of the wedding weekend goes smooth enough. Granati falls down a flight of stairs. Reasoner picks a fight with a red-haired gentleman. All of us are bounced out of a strip club, and the cashiers at the Wiener's Circle heap abuse on us. On Sunday, as we're packing to leave, Eldridge tosses the keys of the Moho to Reasoner and says, "Get her back safely, man. I'm flying home." He turns and saunters off, pants cinched, grandpa high on his waist. Time passes. Eldridge and I fall out of touch. I'm playing in a band, and we're pretty good. But Eldridge ignores all my requests for booking, and that smarts some. But I've managed to convince a lovely girl that I'm worth spending time with and decide to go back to school. I get a phone call from George Paul. "One word, man. It's called Naris." "I think that's an anagram," I say. "Shut up. It's a dinner. The people who do the Grammys. They're throwing it for Rufus Thomas's birthday at B.B. King's Club, right? I want you to come." I drive up to Augusta, Arkansas to meet him. Eldridge now lives in his family's ancestral home and drives between Memphis and Helena for his band booking and King Biscuit fundraising responsibilities. We barrel along a 2-lane blacktop. Eldridge drives the Suburban, and we started drinking early enough to be tight when we get to BB's on Beale, where the event is being held. "Front-loading," George Paul says to me, winking, lifting a tall boy to his mouth. AC/DC comes on the radio, and Eldridge reaches over to turn it up and throws me the devil sign, index and pinky high. There's a small sound, growing louder, and then Eldridge yanks the wheel over, laughing. We've drifted into an oncoming lane and run the car off the road. When we arrive at the Naris dinner, the blues band's in full swing. George Paul introduces me to Rufus Thomas of Walking the Dog fame, and we take our seats next to an older African-American man wearing sunglasses at night, a blind blues man whose name I don't catch. The band, after their set, lets some mic feedback get away from them. It rises into an atonal scream. The blues man raises his hands to cover his ears. They say that when you're blind, all the other senses become more acute. Once the band has the feedback under control, Eldridge leans in close to the man and says clearly, "Hurts so good." Dinner and the drive back to Augusta are uneventful. I don't hear from Eldridge again. A few months later, Boyce calls me to say that George Paul's been in an accident. He borrowed his cousin's cherry apple red Corvette, and I can imagine Eldridge high-kicking in glee, and wrapped it around a tree, crushing his skull. They keep him on life support long enough for us to say goodbye. His father greets me at the hospital saying, "It's a bad deal, John, a bad deal." The day of the funeral is brutally hot, 100 degrees easily. The cotton and beans are already green in the fields that run up and kiss the Eldridge property from where George Paul will be laid to rest. I'm honored to be a pallbearer, and that thought keeps running through my mind, pallbearer, pallbearer, George pallbearer. But I'm dripping with sweat inside my suit and worried my hands will be too slick to keep hold of the coffin. And I'm crying. Selfishly, I'm crying because all grief's about the living. After the minister says the words and the families toss their handfuls of dust on the lowering coffin, Levon Helm and James Cotton step forward. It's been rumored that they'd come, but this is the first I've seen of them. They raise their harmonicas and offer up a slow, swelling rendition of Amazing Grace. On cue, a breeze begins to blow through the mourners, and there's a moment's relief from the heat, as if this were some scene in a movie. Afterward, we stand in the shade outside the Gregory House, where George Paul had lived his last few months. Boyce and Reasoner, Daniel and Lewis, Granati and Woodyard, all the boys are there, smoking cigarettes and drinking sweet tea from solo cups, each of us trying to understand what has happened. A black SUV pulls up, and Levon Helm gets out, accompanied by some friends and handlers. He's an Arkansan, after all, and his roots here run deep. A small man and very lean, he's swallowed by his jacket. He totters over to us, pulls a rumpled pack of menthol cigarettes from a pocket, and says, "You boys got a light?" We fetch him sweet tea and stand there in the fading afternoon sun, motes of cottonwood hanging in the air, while Levon tells us jokes and laughs and does what he can to ease our dismay in the face of the grave. For us boys, it's our first whiff of death. The conversation stills, and he looks out at the field where George Paul is buried. Then he pats my shoulder and says, "You're a hoss, ain't you, son?" "Are you that player George Paul told me about?" And we talk music for a little bit, and I tell him how much joy his songs have given me over the years. When his handlers come to fetch him, he says, "You come up to Woodstock and visit, all right? We got all sorts of music coming through there." And then he's gone, handlers whisking him into the big black vehicle and driving off down the gravel road, back to the highway.
So thank you so much, John Horner Jacobs, for being on the Tin Roof Project here at Tales from the South. It's an incredibly beautiful scene when James Cotton and Levon Helm play Amazing Grace, and then a breeze begins to blow through the mourners at George Paul's funeral. So are there other stories from the funeral that you can tell us about?
Yeah, that's. I just learned this tonight. I was sitting at the table with George Paul's father and Mary and Paul Berry, who know Levon very well. And they just told me tonight that when Levon got the word that George Paul had died, he immediately got in the car, because he does not fly, and drove to Arkansas from New York and stopped long enough in Memphis to pick up James Cotton and buy two brand new harmonicas in the same key, I guess. And they came to the funeral and they played those harmonicas and then laid him on his grave, which was pretty awesome. I mean, this just goes to the character of the man, because Levon really helped us through that. I mean, you know, for me, the whole gist of that, really, that was a point in my life where I stopped being a child, you know, and from there I could move on to, like, become an adult, and he helped that a little bit, you know.
Mm-hmm. So recently, of course, Levon Helm passed away. So after the funeral, were you ever able to talk with him again or see him personally again?
No. You know, for me, most of the whole pursuit of music was sort of tied up in being a idiot adolescent, and after, pretty much right after that, I, you know, went back to school, got another degree, started working. I put aside childish things, and I never did. You know, I always meant to, always wanted to. I thought that was a great, but I did not ever go up there, and it's a sort of a regret. And I never even got up there when I could have seen the Ramble.
In your story, after the Moho road trip, you fall out of touch with Eldridge, and then you manage to convince a lovely girl that you're worth spending time with. Is this your lovely wife, Kendall?
Well, that is something I'm still trying to do. Like, it is a...
It's ongoing.
It is a continuous fight, really, that one. But yes, that was my wife.
Is there a story from your wedding with this same group of characters that you can share?
I mean, other than her saying I do, the only notable thing was my father played a great game of golf on that weekend. There was so much more in this story, or this wedding, like, and I had to, it's funny, the nature of memory is, I thought, you know, you have these things like the wheels coming off of Moho, and you think, oh, I'll never forget this, but I actually had to go back and call all the people involved, and I was calling people, and they were like, I wasn't on that, I wasn't there, you know, so the nature of memory is really sort of indistinct, a lot on this trip, there was so much more crazy stuff that happened, probably because of the amount of alcohol involved. But, nothing happened like that at my wedding.
As a novelist, as a person who gets to create scenarios, people, things, basically lie, how was it writing nonfiction for us?
It's a lot harder than actually writing fiction because, and I have to like sort of tame my instincts to go to the dramatic and as a novelist, you're always looking for conflict to provide the reader with something tangible for conflict. And this, it was like, there's a couple things. You know, I had to look at it as a piece that I was going to read aloud. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like a piece of music in that way. It's not something you're sitting down with a book, you're hearing it. Also, just trying to... It's not true. That's the nature of memory. This is not a true story in the sense that I've colored it and changed it in my mind over time. Mm-hmm. I can't recall our exact conversations, but I tried to catch... Sometimes fiction has more truth in it than actual nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And that's what I tried to strive for, so... I cheated a little bit. Sorry, Paula.
We'll cut that out. Okay, well, we have a few minutes here at the end for audience questions.
Do you ever go to your kids' classroom, like, you know, the thing, what does your dad do? Do you ever go and talk to them? And do you talk to your kids about your books?
One of my daughter's big gripes is they can't... I have a young adult series called The 12-Finger Boy. They're really pissed off that they can't read it. I mean, it has dark, mature, it's mature issues, more, you know, 14 and older. And so they're really sort of angry that they're not allowed to read that. But I have gone to their school and talked to them and lectured these little, you know, four-year-olds about conflict and story and character and how important it is to establish a style very young in your writing career.
As a novelist, do you feel as though that you're able to write stories so that you can vicariously experience things that you were never able to experience in real life?
Yes, definitely. I mean, fiction is escapism. I might ruffle people's feathers by saying this, but all fiction is fantasy. If it did not happen and it's not a strict retelling of facts with citing, it's fantasy. Jonathan Franzen's Freedom is fantasy. He's created a world and peopled it with characters, and just because people walk around having adulterous affairs and using iPhones does not make it any less of a fantasy. It's just more accessible to a larger crowd. So, yes, I mean, for me, I write the stories that I... well, all right, so I come from advertising, and No, well, so this is important. In advertising, I used to work on creative projects that had like a really short lifespan from inception to completion. But with a novel, I have a relationship with this piece of work over a long period of time. I have to be really invested in this process because why do it anyway? Like, if you're not really excited by what you do, why do it? And also, because it takes a long time. And then it takes a really long time for it to get to print, if it ever does. So I tell the stories that I want to hear. And that's really the sort of North Star I shoot for. And it means they're dark sometimes, and most of them are pretty dark stories. But as I age, and also as I mature as a writer, I'm starting to learn how to navigate those waters a little bit better, I think. That was sort of a roundabout way of answering your question, but yeah. So there it is. I'm going to stamp that one, move it out the door.
As an English teacher, I always have on my door, just to inspire students to read and to discuss books with me, the book I've read, the book I'm reading, and the book I will read. So I want to ask you that question as well.
I'm reading like 30 books. The thing about becoming a novelist and actually like getting paid for it and having publishers, like, they send you books all the time. And I just asked my publisher to like send me a few. He sent me like 20. But I'm doing mostly research. I've written this fantasy series. It's like a Western, but it's set in a world where the Rome never fell. So I'm reading a lot of Roman history books. One is called The Roman Legion, a history. It's by Stephen Dando Collins, and it's the history of the Roman Legion, totally. And then I'm rereading a book called Journeyer by Gary Jennings, which is book my dad gave me. It's about Marco Polo, which is, it's not the origin of the kid's game in the swimming pool. It is Polo. No, it's actually the guy who went to visit Kublai Khan. Oh, thank you. Thank you.
So how about our story and storyteller tonight? Thank you so much, John Horner Jacobs, for being on our Tin Roof Project here at Tales from the South. More can be found out about John at his website, johnhornerjacobs.com. Thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing, with additional support provided by AY Magazine, William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American Magazine. Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio Productions. Our graphics are by Robin Steves at Studio B. Our musician is Mark Simpson. Our stage art is by V.L. Cox. Our production engineer is Jay Jones. And our executive producer and host is Paula Morrell. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.
Just yesterday I kissed your tender hand, and you finally told me that I'm the only one. But it's hard to trust you after all these years, 'cause you've been those tender lips. regrets I made somewhere along the way, but our love will always stand the test of time. Well, let's try. It's time to make amends before we pass away. I want you to pretend that our love, it knows no end, and you're still my best friend. So let's try again.